Hey there, foreigners! This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Mohit Aaron. He's the co-founder of the unicorn Nutanix, which recently went to IPO. His latest company is Cohesity, which is revolutionizing the way secondary storage market is. Today's episode is one of my favorite because Mohit goes very deep into a topic quickly and makes profound comments. Mohit talks a lot about the entrepreneurial mindset, when to know you're getting too comfortable and what to do with it, for example. He shares his own methodology for vetting an idea which leads to lesser number of iterations. Building a billion-dollar company is not a chance event, and Mohit's interview proves that. He also talks about tactics for recruiting and why it is important to recruit a strong team and many more. Here is my interview with Mohit. Mohit, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you for talking to me.
So Mohit, you were working at Google from 2003 to 2007, right? And life was very, very comfortable for you in Google, as you mentioned in some of your other interviews as well. Why did you decide to leave?
You know, they say that if you get too comfortable, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. So, no, my motto in life is to pursue, you know, a life of learning, not a life of comfort. Mm-hmm. And I felt that while Google still had a lot to offer in terms of learning, mm-hmm. I felt that by going out in the world and utilizing some of that knowledge, I could actually learn a lot more and also almost do service to the community. I mean, being in Google, being one of 20,000 or 30,000 people, there is only so much you can bring to the world, right? Yeah. But going out there, you can really apply what you learned and also accelerate your learning in a much bigger way.
So looking back, right? Like looking back, it's easy to say I was getting too comfortable, I had to leave. But when you are in the situation, how does someone realize you are comfortable? You know what I mean? Because comfortable state is a very comfortable state, as you say, right? It's hard to think outside of that. So what happens when you get too comfortable? I'm curious to know. So
let's see what happens. You know, I'm...
happened to you, rather?
Going home every day for lunch. I don't have any job insecurity. Mm. I don't think that if I don't meet my project deadlines, anything will happen. In fact, even on the reverse, I don't think if I very aggressively meet my deadlines, anything is going to happen. Because you don't move the needle. Once Google is a big company, they're very successful.
Yeah.
You can try working, you know, late nights and hours and whatnot, but you know, you're not going to move the needle.
Yeah.
And as the company gets bigger, it's also harder to push new ideas. There is a lot of, you know, you have to get agreements from a lot of people and stuff. So the level of nimbleness becomes less. And there comes a point when you're like, okay, I think you can do better, you know, by going out and kind of trying to do it by yourself, rather than being in that environment where, you know, it's very comfortable. You know, everything is taken care of. You know, your health insurance is paid for. You have nice lunches. You open your mouth. You get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
That's comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, that's and I know what discomfort is because I did a PhD and every day was a new challenge, right? Every day I'm thinking new stuff and so I knew the distinction quite well.
Mm.
And that's the fun, the thrill that I crave for.
What, was there a day that you decided that hit you over the head and you're like, okay, this is it, now I'm done?
No, there wasn't a certain day. I think it just grew over me over time. I think so basically I joined Google in early 2003. And the first time I decided, you know, sometime in 2007, I started thinking that, okay, I should leave. But then you're in the middle of some very important projects and your team is looking up to you
mm-hmm.
for things and whatnot. So you're like, okay, once I do this, I should leave. But then that project finishes and it's never the case that, you know, it's only that project because you're normally working on four or five projects at the same time. So slowly you realize you're never going to leave if, you know, you keep doing this. So one fine day you put, okay, I think this is it. I think now I'm going to start handing off whatever projects I have to other people that you have trained and then chart a way out.
Yeah.
So So it wasn't a particular day when I started, okay, I'm out of Google. It was just a process that happened over several months.
Got it. And you also took a significant pay cut to move out of Google, right? And I was amazed to see the numbers. Look at it. So I would let you tell the audience what it was. What was it before and what was it after?
Dude, it was, you know, I think it was a long time back, but I think my take home in Google was easily, you know, $250,000 or more. And then it cut down to at least half that amount, less than half that amount when I went to a startup.
Yeah.
But the passion was not so much to just run out of money. The passion was to run out of learning. And that's what kept me going. It was odd. My parents and my family thought I was mad leaving that life, all that high pay to just go after a small startup. But eventually I say that if I had not done that, I probably would still be at Google. Heck, you know, a lot of people who were in my team in Google are still there doing the same thing that they were doing, you know, 10 years back. And I've had the fortune to do, in my mind, you know, way more when I came out in the real world.
Why did you go to a different startup? At that time, why didn't you go ahead and start your own? What was the mind, what was the thought process behind, okay, let me go start another startup?
Great question. So look, you know, there is a level of confidence that you need to have. I mean, when you go start a startup, there are already lots and lots of headwinds. You know, there are lots of doubts. And the one doubt that you shouldn't have is whether you can do this startup or not, whether you can lead people or not, whether you can, you know, take it all the way or not. And so that confidence was not there. I was financially independent, so that was not the issue. I could have survived without pay or whatever, so that was totally not the issue. But I didn't know, you know, how to go about doing a startup, how to make people, you know, respect you, how to make people look up to you, and how to drive direction, how to do a number of things that startups have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I really was looking for a young company where I could learn those ropes.
Got it.
And that also describes why the money was not that important to me.
Yeah. It was not just youthful exuberance, right, or going to a startup. It seemed like a very mature move.
Yeah, so a lot of people just go to a startup because they feel that, you know, if the startup does well, they'll make a ton of money. And that's really a wrong reason to go to a startup, because the reality is that 90% of startups fail, right? That's the metric somewhere out there, right? So that's really not, and then they'll do it like two or three times and then they get burnt. And then they say, well, startups are not for them. Then they'll go sit in a big company and they literally stop contributing to the world. So I think you need to have some very understood, you know, learnings of what you intend to do in a startup, what you want to gain out of that. And you need to have a thesis. I'll go in a little bit into how now I think about doing startups.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same kind of thinking applies to when you take up a job. Literally, I have this, you know, that you start with a bunch of observations and then you form a thesis on what's going to happen. And based on that, you can literally judge whether a startup is going to make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone should go through that exercise. They should have a thesis on why that startup is supposed to be successful. They shouldn't just jump there because they see some big shot guy, you know, doing it and then they just follow. That's totally the wrong reason to do it.
Yeah.
They should independently look at the business that the startup's in and come up with a thesis on why it's going to succeed and what they want to get out of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the, you know, you want to get something else out of it. For me, it was learning the ropes of doing a startup, right? Yes, I wanted to see that startup succeed, but also I wanted to get something out of it. So I was looking for a startup with young blood and people who were very energetic and they wanted to kind of follow a leader and, you know, that sort of stuff. So that's what I got. That's what I learned. And after, you know, there was a wealth of difference between me coming out of Google in my confidence, in my ability to lead people and lead startups, and my ability to do the same when I came out of that startup.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I was able to do Nutanix.
You were there for 2 years, right? At the other startup, which is AstroData. I just realized we didn't mention what it is.
Yeah, AstroData was the startup. AstroData, I was there for about 2 years, and then I started Nutanix. That's right.
Yeah. And what was the... what motivated you to start Nutanix at that time? Did you have an aha moment, or what was the seedling?
Yeah, so, you know, the funny story is that, you know, as an engineer, I was reasonably happy.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, there comes a point when, like I said, you have to make a few observations and then you have a thesis on where this company is going, right? So I was very happy with my ability to learn how to lead engineers and lead the company. But I was not that happy with the company's direction. And it seems like, you know, I was, you know, no matter what I did, I was not able to influence that direction. You know, the founders of the company were on a set path on how they wanted to execute.
What was your direction and what was the founder's direction at that time?
So I'll, you know, not to go into too many details, but I'll give you one or two samples. I mean, the founders wanted to basically, you know, if they're able to displace a product somewhere, they're happy. I'm not happy. I want to literally make sure that not only have we displaced that product, but the customer is actually very, very happy with it. So they buy more of it. Another example is, you know, they want to charge $1 million for it. In my mind, I think we should grow into the market. So you sell something that's worth maybe $50,000 to $100,000, and then you grow, you know, scalably into that market. So there were the differences like that.
Yeah. And more philosophical, looks like, more than a particular
item. They were research also. I mean, I just want to be respectful of that company. I learned a lot of things there. But, you know, the bottom line is that there were two things I was looking for from that company. One was the ability to lead and that confidence, which I got. And second was that, okay, is this startup going places or not? And the answer to that was that, you know, it seemed like this company is going to make a smaller exit than what I really think the startup should be making based on the way the company is going. And lo and behold, the company made, I think, you know, the exact number was never public, but I think it sold to Teradata for in the neighborhood of $300 million. And so I was not doing a company to make that small an exit. And by all looks, it did seem like the way the company was going, the way the direction was there, that's the way it would make an exit. And so that prompted, okay, you know, let's do something big. And so we did Nutanix. And, you know, Nutanix is obviously a much bigger company, a much wider success. A lot of data centers around the world have embraced the idea of hyperconvergence. That was the excitement, right? Pushing that new idea, hyperconvergence.
So if you were to explain, right, like if you want to take 30 seconds and explain to like my grandmother what hyperconvergence is, how would you put it like in the simplest of the terms for someone who is not technical?
Absolutely. Very simple. Imagine a data center. Imagine there are multiple silos in that data center. Each silo runs a different workload, right? And you say that, hey, in silo A, I'm not running some workload. Can it be used by silo B? The answer is no. That's not hyperconvergence because the infrastructure is not being used by everyone who can use it. Hyperconvergence means that you have one infrastructure and can be used by any workflow. Now, the Nutanix's specific implementation of hyperconvergence was let's not have silos of compute and storage. Let's bring those two silos together. So that was a very particular aspect of hyperconvergence. Will your grandmother understand that definition?
Yes, I understand it. So I'm guessing others can too. So I talked to Dheeraj also of Nutanix earlier. And what amazed me about Nutanix was how close the initial idea was to the final successful model, right? It was quite close, I would say, learning from you and Dheeraj. So my imagination is behind the scenes, there was probably a lot of vetting process that was done to streamline the business model for or the idea for Nutanix. Was that a right judgment? Or
that is the right judgment.
Okay.
So let me take you through that process.
Yeah.
Because I was the one who was behind that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, the foundation of any company, there's two things. One is what is called a vision, and the second is called a pain point. So vision is something broad. And now putting Nutanix into context, with the vision was hyperconvergence, and the pain point was VDI. So let's solve the problem in VDI, right? So pain point is something that people are willing to pay for right away. Nobody pays for the vision, but people pay for their problems. And so you got to go out in the world with the first problem to attack. And then our problem was VDI. Now before we come up with the vision and the pain point, like I said, you need to have a bunch of observations and then a thesis on why this vision and this pain point would succeed. So let's go through the observations. The observations were that from 2000 to 2009, 2009 was when Nutanix was formed, network speeds had barely increased. 1 gigabit was the commodity in 2000, and 1 gigabit networking was the commodity in 2009. And yet CPU speeds and disk speeds had tremendously increased, right? So the non-hyperconverged model, where you used to put storage on one side and compute on the other side and connect that with expensive networking, was clearly a trend that is going to go out of fashion, because the network is not increasing in speed.
Yeah.
And you're increasing the two ends in speed, right? So that was the observation. That was one of the observations that led us to say that these worlds need to be collapsed, right? So that's one positive mark for hyperconvergence. Let me give you another positive mark.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Google. I helped build the Google file system, right? Everything in Google is kept in the Google file system eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And Google built the Google file system in the same way. Even though it's distributed, they used to run it on one side of the network, and then they used to run compute on the other side, and then connect it with networking, and then boom.
Mm-hmm.
But they realized that that's a problem. And so Google came up with its own crude version of hyperconvergence. They merged the two worlds together. They in the same box, they started running both processes. It was very crude.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, if Google needed it, and Google tends to be a little bit ahead of where the industry is, that seemed like something the world would also need. So that was the second observation.
Mm-hmm.
The third observation was that people don't like running these two things on the same box,
mm-hmm.
because they don't trust each other. So how to solve that? Well, you solve that through virtualization, which was taking off. Mm-hmm. That was the third observation. So you combine these three observations together and a bunch of more things, and you find that there was very strong thesis behind that idea,
mm-hmm.
Behind that vision of hyperconvergence. And then all that was left was to identify the first place where we will sell it.
Is that the pain point? You're talking about?
Pain point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
Is that the pain point?
That's the pain point. And so the pain point we identified was VDI, where VDI was very expensive, because people were putting storage on one side, computer on the other side, very expensive networking. By the time you put this solution together, it was very expensive. So like, when we collapse it, it's going to become cheaper, right? So why don't we go sell that? And lo and behold, Nutanix started selling. And so all I'm saying is, if you follow that process, a lot of entrepreneurs don't follow and don't understand what it takes to form a company. A lot of the thinking behind the company is done before the company is even formed.
Mm-hmm.
You literally, there is an understanding that you're going to come up with the vision, the pain point, and then an execution plan. Nutanix had that, and that's why, we never had to change. It was all very solid. Most companies just keep changing, they keep trying new things, and then eventually they run out of money, sometimes they fail.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not my way of doing companies.
Yeah. So Nutanix was very successful when the time you left, right? It was making more than $40 million in annual revenue around the time you left in 2013.
Nice.
And you also had this idea for your next company, Cohesity. So you can go through the process. I'm assuming you probably went through the exact same process of coming up with a thesis. But the same process can be applicable for a small project within a company versus a business which is viable, which can sustain its own employees, which can attract its own funding. So how do you differentiate the two? How did you differentiate the two in terms of in Cohesity?
Fantastic reason. So first of all, I did not get the idea of Cohesity within Nutanix.
Okay.
I had to toil nearly 6 months after I left Nutanix before.
So you left without any idea?
Well, I left with a problem in mind. The problem was that, there is mess in secondary storage. That's it. Because when Nutanix was sold, we saw a lot of customers having problems with backups.
Mm.
Sometimes even backups were even more expensive than, what we used to sell Nutanix for. So you could generally see that there is a problem there, but what would be the solution, I didn't know.
Mm.
And I had to sit for 5 months brainstorming and reading a lot and blah, blah, blah. So really the company was formed in June 2013.
Mm.
And I left Nutanix in Jan 2013. So there was that period of about five, six months. Before I had to, I could come up with that. Now,
that's interesting. One second, because you had such a long time period, right? And it's unsettling for a lot of people to think about that blank period. How did you take it? Like, were you Did you have any doubts, or were you having a strong conviction that something will work out? What was happening at that time? I'm curious to know.
Yeah, I will go there okay. in a second. I want to answer the question that you asked.
Yeah.
Why couldn't I do exact same thing sitting in Nutanix?
Mm-hmm.
So let me answer that. Let me tell you that businesses are a lot about focus. And no single company has been successful in the world selling both primary and secondary storage.
Mm.
So even if I had gotten this idea in Nutanix, I would still not do it within Nutanix.
Mm.
Because even, let's say, the broadest company in the world in storage is EMC. Even EMC had to keep its primary and secondary storage units apart.
Mm-hmm.
Think about data chain and all the other primary storage that EMC sells. They had to keep those worlds apart before they became successful. No one company has been successful in selling both within the same umbrella. So doing something like that in Nutanix would have completely defocused Nutanix.
Mm.
Because Nutanix, primary storage is a lot about IOPS and getting the fastest performance and making sure that you can return responses to requests within a few milliseconds. And a lot about secondary storage is very different. I mean, it's all about, hey, how to do information lifecycle management.
Mm.
Can you take snapshots? How can you take continuous backups? How can you do a bunch of other things which are very different, right? And the sales motions are very different. So you would, defocus the company by doing essentially two companies in one.
Mm.
I mean, look at what's happening to Google. They've recognized that they're kind of getting defocused, and therefore they've carved out the Google part as search, and then there's Alphabet for the more visionary stuff,
yeah.
Right? So you can't do too much stuff. I mean, another example is Riverbed, where Riverbed was trying to do a bunch of storage stuff within Riverbed, but then they realized it's not going to be able to sell. I mean, Riverbed ultimately is a WAN optimization company,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't have the know-how to market a storage product and stuff. So they have, nice storage products, but they just, people don't know about them,
mm-hmm.
right? Have you ever heard of Steam Fusion or, Whitewater? And, these are good products, but they could never see too much traction because, Riverbed didn't know how to sell them and didn't know how to market and all that stuff. So that's why it's actually important to keep a company focused on one big vision. And the vision that Nutanix had was hyperconvergence and primary storage. So there is no need to dilute that vision and go elsewhere, right? Sometimes it's successful, but most often than not, it defocuses the company.
Got it.
So that was the reason. And now your latest question was, was there doubts and blah,
yeah,
blah, blah?
The 6 months limbo, so to say. I don't know if I can use that term because I don't know what was happening at that time, but from the outside, it seems like a limbo, January 2013 to June.
So let's look at it like this. Nutanix had become a mature technology. Like that, the run rate at the time was about 10 million a quarter, so 40 million annually or something like that. And so it was time to look at how else can I contribute to the world, right? So I didn't leave. Yes, I had a semblance of an idea that I may be able to do something in secondary storage. But someone wise then told me, Mohit, you got to detoxify yourself, right? Don't just keep thinking about problems you saw when you were in Nutanix because you're kind of very narrow then.
Mm.
So what I did is I did an exercise. I started a brainstorming session and I divided up the market into segments that could be of potential interest to me, where I could potentially do a company. Now, if I'm into distributed systems and I've done storage all my life, I probably should not be building rockets, right? So clearly rocket science was not in that segment. What was in those segments was, maybe security, virtualization, big data, and storage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those were basically the segments. Then what I did is I studied the market. I looked at all the companies that VCs funded for the last 3 years in those segments. And that had me looking at gaps. Why did the VC fund this company? What were they thinking? So they think that this is a viable direction. But what about that direction? So with this, in 3 or 4 months, you start seeing gaps that you could potentially do a company on.
Mm-hmm. You're kind of either reverse engineering or deconstructing things that have already happened.
No, things that have already happened.
Yeah.
Not reverse engineering.
Deconstructing. That's why I corrected myself.
And basically, it's like, why? Why did this company happen? Which direction is this going? And what about this? Why didn't they think about this?
Mm-hmm.
What about this? If they do this way, then mm-hmm. wouldn't this be a trend?
Yeah.
That's kind of thinking. And it's kind of hard. This is like really hard phase of a startup.
Mm-hmm.
But then once you do that enough, you start asking questions and, mm-hmm. and you start seeing some gaps in which to you can do potential companies.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the understanding starts. Remember, vision and pain point.
Mm-hmm.
So every vision that you have, every gap that you recognize needs to be vetted. So I have 10 filters that I take through. I can give you some filters. For example, one of them is this a good neighborhood? Have people tried this before, and how many companies have died trying to attempt something like that, right? If a lot of companies have died, it's probably not fundable because VCs are going to be scared funding that idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
One example is doing something on desktops.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just a lot of companies that have just not done well in that space. And so you do another desktop company, probably VCs will be anxious in funding you, right? That's just one example. So I have some 10 other filters like this. You know, how much time will it take you to reach 100 million in revenue?
Mm-hmm.
What pivot points? You know, I have 10 such filters. So now I apply all these filters to each one of the potential visions I come up with, right? And then it becomes narrowed down to maybe 2 or 3 things that really are left that I could do a viable company on.
Yeah.
And it totally, then I maybe talk to some customers. You know, eventually it became clear that the idea behind Cohesity is the one that is the most promising.
Mm-hmm.
And again, same way as in Nutanix, the exact idea we started with in 2013 is precisely what we are doing today. Because the vision, the pain point, how it's going to unroll in terms of execution. When I raised money in November 2013 from Sequoia, I told them in my first board meeting, then in October 2015, I will launch the company. Like, the plan was that finally executed.
Mm-hmm.
Plan was laid out that this month I'm going to do this month I'm going to do that. So it was just a matter of executing that plan.
Got it.
And on October 2015, we launched the company. Mm-hmm. We GA'd the company.
Mm-hmm. So what is the thesis of Cohesity? If you want to give a quick overview on what the thesis of Cohesity is.
Yes. So, first of all, the problems were that the real problem that got me down this path was wire backups and insurance policy. Why do people spend billions of dollars worldwide on backups and then not use them, right? Why do they only use them when they want to retrieve something? So that was the thesis. But then I started looking at, okay, what more can you do with backups? Well, you can, look at secondary storage, and maybe you can run tests and dev on that. Maybe you can run some analytics on that, right? Okay, let's look at the whole secondary story. I see more problems. I see a lot of fragmentation. People have to go to different vendors to buy stuff. They're all running in silos. Remember hyperconvergence? And now we have stuff running in silos. Why can't we run them together on one platform, right? And now, so why can't we hyperconverge secondary storage? So now comes the thesis. The thesis is that we can get rid of all that mess in secondary storage by just hyperconverging them into one platform. And that should really sell. The pain point is, let's go do that just for backups, because backups tend to be very expensive. People have to buy backup software from one guy, backup storage from another guy, and put them together to do anything, right? That's mm-hmm. very complicated because you're dealing with multiple vendors. It's very expensive. So that's the pain point we sell it to. So very, very well-defined vision and very precisely defined pain point. And that's what we're executing on.
Yeah. So you are a technical founder, right? So you can go through that process yourself. Or does it help to be a technical co-founder in your case, because of the area that you're dealing with? It seems to be very technical, right?
Yeah. So, whenever someone does a company, a technical co-founder is a must. In fact, I would say that a product guy is a must because actually, I am also really a product guy. The kind of thinking I'm taking you through,
mm-hmm.
this is a product thinking. A technical guy, what he does is he will take the product thinking and translate it into an implementation mm-hmm. and a design. I happen to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what you need as a founder, as a person who starts a company. You don't need a sales guy to start a company. You don't need just a business guy who, knows how to just, talk to customers and sell. You don't need that guy alone. A must-have is a technical guy and a product guy. Those are the
When did you learn the product-related skills?
The product-related skills, I'll just say that I learned it the hard way. I mean, my first company was a great teacher. I was in a company called Zambeel.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated with my PhD, I spent, 2 years there. And I learned a lot of things not to do because that company didn't go so well, right? That was the first company I joined. It was not my company. Mm-hmm. And I could then sit and say, okay, well, where did the founders go wrong? What were the problems? Oh, they should have seen this. There was no thesis. There was no blah, 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 right? So over time,
Are you able to share what failed with Zambil?
Absolutely. So Zambil was a company that was trying to build a distributed NAS, a network attached storage, right? And so the question you have to ask, okay, your vision is a distributed NAS, right? So you're going against a company like Network Appliance. What's the pain point? Why would people pay for that, right? Why would they be attracted to distributed stuff? Okay, the only thing you have to sell is you can give them phenomenal amounts of storage. Who needs that? Who has a pain point that needs that? Because at that time, people didn't have that big a storage requirement. So now your customer set is very small, right? Now, how long do such a... So basically, we're talking about companies that maybe are AT&T or something like that. And how long do they take to buy such a product? Well, they'll take a year. So now you can think, you can see, right? You just argue, just basically, if you ask simple questions, you can argue that you really don't have a market. You don't have too many customers who can buy such a product. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, they just kept building on that vision. And eventually, when they started selling, they realized that you know they weren't able to sell because there wasn't a market for it. And then there is something called, you know, I also talk about this, you know you have to understand not just the vision and the pain point, but also what's the selling motion. The selling motion is that people get attracted to your product by the vision, by the your promise to solve the pain point. But then the first thing they check, they're going to check a bunch of check boxes because they're used to a branded product, right? They're going to check, hey, is the performance good enough? Is this good enough? And if you're not, they're like, yeah, I'm impressed with the vision and what you can do for me. But hey, man, I'm used to a bunch of stuff. You're not even giving me that.
Mm-hmm.
Did Zambil worry about those checkboxes? No. They only saw those checkboxes once they placed the product in the hands of customers. Did they place the product in the hands of customers early to get that feedback? No. They waited until their money was nearly running out. Mm-hmm. And they were all assuming that this product would start flying off the shelves. So there were a lot of learnings like that on what not to do. You know, kind of go early, get that feedback, understand what checkboxes the customers really, really need, because they don't need 100% of the checkboxes, but there are some must-haves that they need, right? Be it performance, but even within performance, what level of performance is good enough?
Mm-hmm.
You need to take the Guinness Book of World Records, or do you need to be, there's a threshold that's good enough, right? So you need to understand those answers. And that's what I learned. And then just management. I'll tell you a story. I made, you know, very good relationships in Zambil in sort of the second tier engineers. And so why not the first year? Because the first year...
What do you mean by second tier engineers? Can you...
Well, execs versus non-execs, right? Execs as in the CEO, COO, and that sort of people.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
They used to sit in offices.
Mm-hmm.
And we all were sitting outside in cubes and whatnot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And any time there was a fire... None of the execs, none of the architects was involved.
Mm-hmm.
They were all sitting in their offices shouting orders. Mm-hmm. So guess what? We developed relationships between ourselves. We didn't identify with those execs,
mm-hmm.
right? We didn't have a following or a loyalty to those guys, which is a learning. Mm-hmm. Now I make sure that whenever I do a company, I never, never sit in an office. I'll sit in an office when all my people will sit in an office. I'll give you another example. You know, let's take an example from a master. When I was at Aster, even though I was their main architect, I used to sit with the people. The founders used to sit in their offices. And the founders, you know, this was very funny, but they ordered laptop bags. They ordered cloth laptop bags for the engineers, and they ordered leather laptop bags for all the execs. Now, that's who's going to stick together, right? Now you're creating a class system.
Mm.
Yes, we're all, so now when I went out of Aster, everyone wanted to follow me. Because they identified with me. They didn't identify with, you know, those execs that were carrying the leather bags, right? Mm. So these are the differences.
Yeah.
So you never create that class system. These are the learnings you get from the past experiences.
So you mentioned that when you left Aster, people wanted to follow you, right? And you were successful at Nutanix, and from there, people wanted to follow you. And even investors were knocking on your door when you started Cohesity because you had a track record of building a successful company. So when so many people are knocking on your door, how do you filter between them on who to work with and who not to work with? Because it's easy to get requests for, whatever, I'm a software engineer and I want to work at Cohesity. You must have gotten hundreds or thousands of them, and you probably hired only tens of them.
Fantastic question. So look, let me make a distinction there between engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers are relatively easy to pick because you can ask a bunch of questions on the board, ask them to solve problems, and then you know, you kind of know where they stand. It's actually very hard to engage with non-engineers because it's very fluffy, right? How do you hire a marketing guy? How do you go with a VC? So now, and by the way, my selection was not perfect when I left Nutanix, and I've learned since then a lot of things. Now what I do is I look for a couple of things. First of all, of course, I go for a lot of references, right? It doesn't matter how good the person smells. I mean, anyone can fool you in an interview, especially if it's a non-technical interview. But I look for a lot of references, and I make it a point. I look for references from peers as well as people who reported to that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the key, because those guys have less of an incentive to lie. If I'm a person and I'm giving a reference for someone who reported to me, I kind of view that as my kid, right? And I'd be really, I'll think five times before giving a negative reference. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm really pissed with the guy, I try to say positive things about him. But people who report to you, they have an incentive to kind of say the truth. They're like, oh, this guy treated me well, or this guy didn't treat me well, or whatever. Right?
That's interesting.
This guy was actually useful or not. So that's one thing. But you don't always get that. The second thing that I look for, and I'll give you some real examples in this, on how I chosen some people and chosen some not, is how do those people treat people who they don't really care about, as in they don't have any need to impress those people. So if they're treating others well, then they're good people. Let me give you an example. I once had a person who was interviewing for a head of marketing role, right? And that guy came from a big company, and he had worked with some of my employees, some of the people that had already joined me. And he came and he didn't even he actually used to sit next to them, literally, for 5 years. He came, he didn't even say hi, he didn't even know their names. He didn't know their names, right? They are the ones who walked up to him and said, hey, remember me? And he's like, oh, yeah. So he's kind of lukewarm, right? And in the interview with me, he's dropping big names like David Bechtolsheim or David Chatterton, Andy Bechtolsheim, right? That sort of names. So I'm like, dude, you spent 5 years working with these people and you don't acknowledge them, you don't know their names, and you're dropping me names on these big guys? You're not the guy for me, right? Unless a guy is humble and he treats everyone well, everyone like a human, I mean, you go for a goodness in the person. And if the person is fundamentally good, he will probably be good in your company. And those are some of the things I look for, especially in these non-engineering hires.
Yeah. So when I asked you this question, right, and I didn't expect such a structured answer, for example. So you seem to be thinking a lot of structure in most things that you deal with, right? Like you have a structure for your startup, you have a structure for...
So the way I do it, life is about learning, like I said, and I've been burnt. And so when I get burnt, I actually think a lot, okay, what did I do wrong? How can I improve? And how can I not make that mistake again? So the reason I gave you that answer was not because I had just thought about it right here. Because it's in a startup, I tell you, one mistake, my mistake, costs the company 6 months of its time. And so it doesn't have room for that many mistakes. So when I make a mistake, I really think really, really seriously about what I can do to not make that mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where some of this thinking comes from.
What is one of your, you mentioned Zambil, for example, and small other things. What has been your biggest failure till date? Because people talk about their successes, right? But not everyone talks about their failure because it's icky.
Oh, man. There is no dearth of failures. And Zambil itself, I tell you, there was a point in time when I decided I'll take it on myself to uplift the company, even though I was just a principal engineer there. For a while I did, but then you find that the tide is against you and there's nothing you can do. But let's talk, I've made decisions, that have gone against my gut saying that this is wrong.
Yeah.
I've seen people treat other people badly. Mm-hmm. I've seen people treat and do a lot of politics outside. And my gut says that one day Orich, you know, one day he'll do the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
But he's so sweet and nice to me that, you know, I kind of, my eyes are like, you know, maybe he's fine, maybe I'm wrong or something, right? Now I don't do that. No matter how a person treats me, I look at how the person is treating others before I judge how he's going to treat me in the future. I made this mistake. Yeah. I will never make it again. I have thought about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't now work with people who just, you know, smell like honey and, you know, treat me well, because a lot of people are flatterers.
Yeah.
I look how the person treats a person who he has no reason to treat well, how he's with that guy. And whether he's playing politics and stuff like that. So that's what I look for.
Yeah. So do you journal a lot? Because to translate these amorphous ideas into set rules or criteria, you need to structure your thinking. So how do you, I have also like thousands of amorphous thoughts and I come up with very few concepts, but how do you go through that process?
Yeah, I don't release as much, but I do indeed write articles within the company, and okay. I share it with my people.
I see.
So I'll tell you the gist of some. You know, one of my articles was if five smart people around you are saying five objective smart people are saying something, it's probably true.
Hmm.
So if they're saying that you're making a mistake on something, or you're being political, or you're being this or that, it's probably true. They got to be objective,
mm-hmm.
right? If five people are saying that, that's a very good rule to run a company,
mm-hmm.
because there are people giving you Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then your ego says a lot of things that you're doing that are nice and this and that. But there are five people objectively saying, Mohit, you're wrong. You're mm-hmm. doing this wrong. You better be very careful, because yeah. you are indeed wrong, right? If five, it's a strong statistic.
Yeah, yeah.
That worked very well for me. So I actually wrote an article on that. And I showed it. So, you know, there was a guy in my company. He laughs at it, and he has given me the permission to share it. I won't share his name,
mm-hmm.
but he was, coming up with things like, I deserve this because blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I am doing this right because, and I showed that article to him. I'm like, dude, look at what five people are saying. Five people. So he was the guy who managed some of my UI, and there were enough people saying objectively that the UI is not great.
Mm-hmm.
And he was insisting it is. And I'm like, look at the difference. There are five objective people saying that the UI is not great for these reasons. So you should listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he backed off. He's like, Mohit, you're right. I got to listen to them. And I can now tell you, we have gotten so many compliments about our UI. And me and him laughed that, look, if you had not listened, you would not have improved. You would have keep drinking your Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So it goes on and on and on that, you know, how valid this is that, you know, if you just listen to five objective people, you can learn so much about what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
That's just all the articles I wrote. Then I wrote an article about leadership on what we expect from leaders. You know, well, we expect tens of things from leaders, but one of the things we expect is that the leaders are not emotional. Well, everyone has emotion, but they got to take, decisions without emotion. I'm feeling, you know, depressed. I'm feeling down. These are not leadership qualities. The leadership qualities are, you know, doesn't matter how bad or good the situation is. Even if the situation is good, you shouldn't be jumping around. You should not be screeching, ah, blah, blah. That's also a sign of, a red sign, because a good leader has a limited range of emotion. And that's the emotion range that he displays, especially when things are bad. Look, people look up to him for strength. If he's the guy, oh, I'm feeling bad, I'm feeling down, I'm frustrated,
mm-hmm.
The whole company will go down. So I wrote an article about leadership and a bunch of these traits that leaders need to have.
Yeah.
So, I do write. I just don't release as much in the open world.
You should.
I should.
You totally should. Because you have so many of these mental models which you have spent probably years or decades in some cases, right? Honing them. I have many mental models myself as well, and I know what it takes to build one. The process of coming from a thought to a model is excruciating. In some cases, it takes years of honing, right?
I'd like to say that people sometimes see the end product,
yeah.
And they see what is used in the end product. They don't see what's discarded, because to come to the end product, you have to discard thousands of things before you arrive there, right? So it's filtered information you're seeing. And sometimes it looks very intuitive and like, what's so hard about that?
Yeah.
But dude, we have eliminated a lot of things that could have been put there and we have not put them there. And so it's actually a crux of a lot of filtration that, you know, becomes a golden nugget.
Yeah.
So absolutely, you're totally right. You know, that's what I love to do sometimes.
Well, what are some of the things that inspire your thought? Other people, books, life experiences, anything that you'd like to share as resources for people listening?
Yeah, I love people who, people ask, one time someone asked me, who is a celebrity that you admire, right? Mm-hmm. Who's a famous character in history that you admire? And, you know, while anyone can come with tons of examples, I thought about it and then I said Einstein. Now, it looks, a lot of people would probably say Einstein. Ask them why. Oh, he developed the E is equal to MC squared formula. No, that's not the reason why I'm impressed. I'm impressed because the guy was besotted with light.
Mm-hmm.
He had one passion in life. That passion was light. He thought about light for God knows how many years before he came up with that formula E is equal to MC squared. That's why I love the guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I find that when I'm besotted with something, when I think about that for years and years and years, I come up with something that's beautiful and something that I can share with the world, right?
Yeah.
And that reason I like Einstein, because of that passion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all see light. We all experience light. Imagine what it takes to just keep on thinking day
about
after
it.
Day after day about why light is the way it is, right?
Yeah.
That's passion.
Yeah.
That's what I about the guy.
So you mentioned in another interview that you are an introvert, and I was like, oh, he is kidding. He is not an introvert. He talks so much. He's surely an extrovert. But as I'm talking to you over this 1 hour, I see the introvertish aspects in you. Like you seem to like to sit down and think, take your space and go deeper into something.
My family knows. My family knows how much I value my personal time, because that's the time I need to think about all this. And I get, really agitated if I don't get my personal time. But
what?
Then, yes, once I've done that thinking, now I'm, and this has grown, you know, I wasn't always like this. And now I want to share that with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the world sometimes sees me as an extrovert, but I totally am an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally. If I don't get every day some time to myself, I'm in pain. You know, I'm like, oh, just leave me alone.
Yeah, it must be hard to do as a founder, right? How do you carve it out? Like, what are some of the tricks you have to, like, do you have a day in the week that you take for yourself, or how do you do it on a practical level?
I need every day. I need some time every day. So, it is hard, but imagine I have time and I have no meetings. I just come, sit in a conference room and think.
Mm.
I go home, while I'm having sometimes dinner with my children and my wife, I'll talk a little bit and then suddenly I'll go quiet and I'm thinking. When they go to sleep, I normally reserve an hour or so. Earlier I used to do much more. Now I try to be a little bit more disciplined about when I go to sleep. So I reserve about an hour of just personal time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a time when I could just do work or I could just sit there. Sometimes my wife would come into my office and she'll basically not find me doing anything. I'm just sitting there, staring at the screen. I'm actually just thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I do find time like that, and I, like I said, I do get agitated, and I'm not a good creature to be around if I don't have that time for myself. That's my introverted nature, and all the things you're hearing about how I think is basically a result of that thought process.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think when I'm talking to people, right? That's when I'm really disseminating knowledge. But I think when I'm sitting by myself and just doing nothing else.
Yeah. What advice do you have for others starting out?
Can you say that again? I think there was a blip in the internet.
Sorry. What advice do you have for others starting out from scratch right now?
One advice I have is run behind your passion. Don't run behind money. Money is a result of passion. If you run behind money, people who run behind money sometimes make some of it. They probably will not make a lot of it. And very frankly, beyond a certain point, money is not important. What's important is really your passion. That's what keeps you fulfilled. That's one advice. Second advice I give to a lot of entrepreneurs is don't do company just for the sake of doing a company, right? Do it because you're really passionate about that idea. Your passion should be such that if no one funds you and you're in pain and you can't even rent, a nice place, you could literally do it in a garage and you won't mind. You would do it in a ghetto. If you have that kind of passion for doing it, then do it. Mm-hmm. Don't do it for sake of it. So you should really feel that this is the right thing to do, because your passion is the one that will pull the world to join you. They see that passion emanating from you, that this is the right thing to do, right? And you have logical reasons on why it should happen. It's not just, you're just stuck to it despite all logic. You have very logical reasons on why things should be done this way. Mm-hmm. Look at hyperconvergence, right? Collapsing the compute and storage, collapsing those silos into one, I can give you logical reasons why the world should look like that. And therefore I become passionate because I cannot find any logical reason why things should not be that way, right? And now I can fire up people because, my passion emanates and infects them, and they feel that we all have a common mission. Mm-hmm. That's when companies are born. That's when strong companies and big companies are born. You think we live in a world where I have Googles and Facebooks and Twitters and Ubers and whatnot, in my neighborhood. They can steal away engineers like that. They even have more money. Yeah. People are here because of their passion, because they're part of this mission. And that's the mission you've got to inculcate. If an entrepreneur has that, then he can do companies.
Yeah.
Don't just do companies, save doing companies.
Oh, one question before I ask you for your contact. So what is one thing you think I can do better as an interviewer? I wanted to ask it on air so that I can be accountable for improving on it.
I think you did a pretty good job. Maybe, I don't know, you can, let me speak a little bit less. I spoke a lot. you can steer the questions your way, but I'm just, spreading hairs here. I think you did a fairly good job.
Okay.
And maybe one thing I can say is that you heard some of these things elsewhere, so maybe you could steer me. I don't remember what I said elsewhere. I don't know if I'm repeating some of the stuff I said elsewhere, so you could steer me in a direction that people may not have heard before.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, just throwing things like
got
that.
Got it. So what is the best way for if someone is listening by, is inspired by you and want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to contact you?
So the best way to contact me is, send me an email. Email works the best.
Mm-hmm.
My email is my first name dot my last name at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Mohit.gmail.com. That's the easiest way to reach me.
Mm-hmm.
People can also contact me on my company email. The same email works. The same. The username is the same. Mohit.aaron@quizzy.com. That would work. So email is the best. I don't prefer people calling me on my cell phone because I'm in the middle of something, maybe middle of thinking, and then someone calls me. So phone numbers are something that I tend to not give out that easily. But it's the best, and I can respond in good time. They can connect to me on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn profile is out there. They can connect and then ask, send me messages on LinkedIn. That's perfectly fine.
I'll leave all that information, including your email and the LinkedIn. LinkedIn account details in the show notes as well. Mohit, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is Rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.